Tonight's topic, religious Zionism, democracy, and the Palestinians. I want to say, in the interest of full disclosure and transparency, I found this session very hard to prepare. And I'll just say that personally, when I went through a phase of my life of thinking I might be a full-time academic, my main field of research was actually the history of religious Zionist thought. And one of the things that I think has been one of the tragedies of religious Zionism is the ways in which the 1967 war, the triumphant victory in that war, ended up breaking an awful lot of what I think was valuable and powerful and compelling about religious Zionism. Here I'm just being, you know, speaking totally honestly. And actually, the longest academic article I've written was a long piece on the ways in which it seems to me that Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who we'll talk about later, really broke a lot of what was most powerful about religious Zionism. Before we dive into this sort of halachic, the legal dimensions of this question, I want to begin by saying that there are two ways that one could decide in advance to preempt, if you will, the technical halachic discussion, the attempt to take rabbinic and medieval sources and apply them, however uneasily, to a contemporary political situation. One is, in a theological frame, you could affirm some form of the idea of progressive revelation, according to which God's will is revealed over time as history unfolds. In other words, you would be saying that as modern believers, we just know that democracy, of some sort at least, is the best way for human beings to live and govern themselves politically. Best for the protection of human dignity and human rights, best for the protection of religion from its own worst impulses and instincts, etc. The idea of progressive revelation is not uncomplicated, uncontroversial, and not so easy to defend. But many of us act as if we believe in that anyway, right? If I stopped many people on this call and asked you, you might say some version of, yeah, we just know. It's almost like modernity has taught us in some profound way that this is sort of the bottom line. Democracy needs to be the way we live together. Or you could affirm that the state of Israel was founded as a modern secular state, founded by modern secular people, and that it therefore ought to conform to the norms of modern secular states. That, by the way, was the position of what I will call the later Yeshayahu Leibowitz. Yeshayahu Leibowitz, as some of you may know, started out as very much an ideologue of religious Zionism, and then for various reasons, I could talk about this later or not during the Q&A, abandoned that position and basically said, you know, I don't want to live in the delusion that this is somehow a state that ought to be governed by halachic sources from the Middle Ages. This is a modern secular state. That's just what it is. So, two possibilities you have to preempt some of the discussion we're about to have. But what we're going to do for the bulk of tonight is dive into how an array of thinkers has tried to deal with the ways that our inherited halachic tradition makes creating a society in which non-Jews are treated equally not so simple, and how they try to wrestle with those sources. It'll become clearer as we go. Scholars who have studied the unfolding of religious Zionist psak halacha, religious Zionist halachic decision-making since the founding of the state, tend to delineate two separate and very different periods. First, the generation of the founders, and second, the generation that comes of age around the time of 1967, either, you know, shortly before or shortly after. So I want to talk first about the generation of the founders. They offered halachic arguments for granting full and equal rights to Gentile citizens of the state. From their perspective, and this is really critical, the question was fundamentally religious. How should non-Jews living in Israel be understood in religious terms? In other words, for example, the primary example, should they be considered Ovdei Avodah Zarah, idolaters, or not? The question was fundamentally about the religions they practiced. The generation after 1967 influenced by Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook and by the ideology of Gush Emunim, for them, they are living in a new political situation in which there were now many Arabs who were living under Israeli rule but were without civil rights, right? A situation that continues today. They treat the question, accordingly, as more political. For them, the halachic question tends to be about the national status of Arabs in Israel and about the implications of that status for the political struggle over control of the land. In other words, to make that point very simple, the generation of 1948 is asking a religious question about the religion of non-Jews living in the land of Israel. In other words, what is the status of Islam and Christianity in Jewish law? The generation of 1967, while it gestures in that direction, is primarily asking a question that is about nationality, that is about the national status of Palestinians more than it's about Muslims or Christians per se. And the key group around Tzvi Yehuda Cook, the settler rabbis, will take an approach that denies equal rights to the Arabs living under Israeli control. Their goal, in other words, is to defend Israeli rule over the West Bank without having to grant citizenship to Arabs living under that rule. Now, let me just say here, I'm going to be saying some things that will no doubt be offensive to some of you, as some of them are offensive to me, but I'm trying to sort of lay out these positions without needing to caveat them at the end of every sentence. I also want to just say, it is not the case that Tzvi Yehuda and his circle speak for everyone in the religious Zionist camp, although they have had a greater and greater and more powerful voice as time has gone on. Witness the supposedly moderate settlement of Efrat and the percentage of people in Efrat who voted for Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, for example, right? They have really taken over the being the public voice of religious Zionism. So I want to begin now to dive into the generation of 1948 by talking about Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, whose dates are 1888 to 1959. He is, as a young man, the chief rabbi of Ireland, and then eventually serves as the chief rabbi of Palestine and then Israel, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Palestine and then Israel, from 1936 all the way to 1959. Herzog makes the following very simple argument. He says, the birth of the state of Israel is dependent on the consent of the United Nations, which will require granting rights to religious and political minorities. The nations, Herzog says, will not relent on this demand. This is not something that's up for negotiation. If they're going to allow us to have a state, they're going to insist on basic democratic norms like minority rights. So if we want to have a state, we will have to find a way to create a synthesis between, or at least a way of holding together with integrity, both the nation's embrace of democracy on the one hand, and those areas of Jewish law which would seem to not be supportive of democracy on the other. We simply have to find a way. To put that in another way, the state is not a manifestation of total Jewish sovereignty over the land. It is more like a partnership, this is his language, offered to the Jews by the nations of the world. We don't control it. This is extremely important because, I really want to sort of make this point very clear, some of the most radical and, from a modern perspective, troubling Jewish sources about how non-Jews are to be treated in a Jewish land depend on the notion of Yad Yisrael Tkefa, the idea that the Jews are in power. What Herzog and his generation want to argue is, I know we're going to have a state, but we are not in power in that way. We are entirely dependent on the United Nations. We are entirely dependent on the nation's permission to have a land. We can't just say, oh, we're sovereign in the land. We can do what we want. Even if the halakha, Herzog says, actively prohibited Gentiles from living in the state, which, as we'll see according to Herzog, it does not. But even if it did, we would not be able to enact the halakha in areas where the nations of the world would not consent to it. We are simply not living in a time where that is possible. Now, please note, this is a practical argument. This is an argument that says, to the extent that Judaism is not, that Jewish law is not democratic, we don't have the right to implement it. And one of the questions, by the way, that if this is of interest, that scholars and interpreters of Rav Herzog argue about is, to what extent was he sneaking in what his own values were, somewhat progressive and democratic, and to what extent was he actually being totally upfront and saying, look, if I had total power, I wouldn't create a democracy because that's not what the Rambam wanted. But I don't have total power, so I'm going to create a democracy because that's the only way that I can have a state. Now, to the technical halachic argument, and here you're going to have to kind of fasten your seatbelt a little bit. To become a full citizen of the Jewish people, according to Jewish law, you need to convert. There is no other way. You become what in halachic terms is called a ger tzedek, a convert. But halacha, he points out, does recognize another category and type of person, that is a ger toshav, that is a resident alien, we might say, which Herzog describes as, I'm quoting here, a sort of partial conversion, as it were, a partial naturalization. Yet here is the problem. And this is the text that everyone who cares about the halachic dimensions of this question will get stuck on. This is the problem. What my late mother would have called ha'etzem shebagaron, the bone in your throat that keeps you totally stuck. The Rambam has all of these laws that say idol worshippers cannot live among us and are not even allowed to visit and not allowed to do business unless and until they accept the seven Noahide laws, right? And if they do accept the seven Noahide laws, then they are considered ger toshav. But now look at the line that I've underlined in the Hebrew and the English. This is the line that makes everyone crazy. Ve'ein mekablin ger toshav ela bizman shehayovel noheg. We do not accept gerim toshavim except in the time that the Jubilee is observed. Rather, we only accept gerei tzedek, full converts to Judaism. So in other words, what you're going to have here is for all these people who are inside of this halachic conversation is, wait a minute, if we're going to grant full rights to Muslims and Christians in the land, we have to call them gerim toshavim. But the Rambam says there are no gerim toshavim until the messianic future. So what do we do now? How do we deal with the Rambam? Now, I want to say, this is Shai Hel talking for a moment. Please keep in mind that almost all halachic sources about what will happen under Jewish sovereignty are written at a time when sovereignty is a mere fantasy. They are fantasies about power by a powerless people. And one of the challenges becomes, well, what happens when you have power? It's an ethical challenge, but it's also a practical challenge. Do these sources leave you enough maneuverability to be a modern state? Think back on what I talked about last week about Chaim David Halevi, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, trying to carve out spaces where a government can function like a government and not be bound by poskei halacha sitting in a Beit Midrash somewhere. In other words, we have here in Maimonides the claim a non-Jew may live in the land only if he accepts the seven Noahide laws and becomes a ger toshav. But the rub is, we don't accept gerim toshavim. Now, note for a minute, if you take this text to its radical conclusion, and you think that Yad Yisrael Tkefa, and you think that the Jews really do have power, that this is a halachic situation of Jewish power, you will have to take this to extreme conclusions. You will have to expel non-Jews from the land. You will have to prohibit their visiting as tourists, as business people, or even as diplomats. Interestingly, but not surprisingly, no posek, no halachic decision maker, no matter how extreme, has advocated for this, which on some level might suggest that everyone reads somewhat selectively whether or not they want to admit it. Right? People have been willing to use this to deny Muslims the status of a ger toshav, but have not been willing to use it to prevent evangelical Christians from practicing tourism in the old city. I'm saying this not in a politically loaded way. I think it's just actually really interesting to note that. Meaning, the Maimonides text is so extreme that people feel they have no choice but to be selective in which extremism it expresses, they embrace. Herzog and many others point out, please remember, for the love of God, that Yad Yisrael is not tkefa, Yad HaGoyim tkefa. The Jews are not in power. The Gentiles, in fact, are in power. What other positions are available in Jewish law to poskim, like Rav Herzog, the chief rabbi, who wants to find a way to legitimate halachic norms, legitimate through the use of halachic norms, Muslims living in the land? Please keep in mind, he already has a default argument, which is none of this applies because we have to do what the Gentiles say. Right? So this is a kind of like, if any of you have learned Talmud in a serious way, you can almost say this is a kind of mimanafshach argument. This is like, if you want to say that the Jews have power now for real, I'll show you why it's still okay for Muslims to live here. By the way, the Jews don't have power here. So any way you want to go, you're going to have to say that Muslims can live here. That outcome is, if you will, predetermined. Now, the Ra'avad, Rambam's prime critic and commentator, says very simply, source 2, Eini mashvelo bishivat haaretz. I don't agree with him when it comes to dwelling in the land. In other words, one who accepts the seven Noahide laws may dwell in the land even during times when we do not observe the Jubilee and might not be able to technically call him a ger toshav. Meaning, what allows you to dwell in the land is not the technical legal status of ger toshav, but rather the embrace and fulfillment of the seven Noahide laws. The third source that becomes central to this conversation is Rabbi Yosef Karo, best known for authoring the Shulchan Aruch, but here his commentary on the Mishneh Torah called Kesef Mishneh. He says, the Rabbad is saying that even though we don't accept a ger toshav during times when the Jubilee is not practiced, nevertheless, if one accepted the seven laws, why would they be prevented from dwelling in the land? After all, there is no concern that such people will lead Jews astray. This is another halachic source that I'm bracketing for the sake of like our sanity, called Shema Yachtiyu, lest they lead the Jews astray. But now comes Rav Yosef Karo's chidush, his innovative reading. And according to our master, Maimonides, it seems that yes, of course, if one accepted the seven laws of his own accord, we do not prevent him from dwelling in the land. Rambam's point was only that the court does not accept them. This is not a convincing reading of Maimonides, as many people will note, and yet they will choose to rely on it in their halachic decision-making. So just to be clear, you have three halachic positions here. You have the Rambam, who essentially says, there's no ger toshav in the time of the Yovel. You have, in the time when there's no Yovel. When there's no Jubilee, there's no ger toshav. You have the Ravad, who says, okay, but that does not mean they can't live in the land. All they have to do to live in the land is obey the seven Noahide laws. And then you have the third position of Yosef Karo, who says, Mr. Ravid, Mr. Ra'abad, you are not actually disagreeing with Maimonides. That's what he meant too. All he was saying was, you can't have the legal status of a ger toshav. But obviously, if you follow the Noahide laws, you're allowed to dwell in the land. Rambam would agree with Ra'abad that a non-Jew who had accepted those laws had kind of a blanket permission to live in Eretz Yisrael. And as I mentioned, many are skeptical, for reasons we will not get into, that this is a correct or plausible interpretation of Maimonides, but they are nevertheless willing to rely on it halacha lema'aseh for practical law. The person who most famously says, look, the Ra'abad and Rabbi Yosef Karo have made this possible for me, is Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook. What are Rav Herzog's sources? First, he bases himself on the Ra'abad and the Rabbi Yosef Karo that we just read, according to whom, again, to belabor this point, one is permitted to dwell in the land whether or not one is technically a ger toshav. He also turns to Rav Kook, who himself followed Ra'abad and Rabbi Yosef Karo, and who held that the prohibition on non-Jews owning land in the land does not apply to non-idolaters, and Muslims, to be sure, according to all opinions in Jewish law, are decidedly non-idolaters. you have some medieval philosophers who are preoccupied with something that bothers them no end, which is that Muslims appear to be stricter about monotheism than Jews are. There ain't no Muslim Kabbalah, for example. The reason Rav Kook made this argument, just to make your head spin for a minute, was he wanted to find a way to make it legal to sell land to Muslims during Shemitah. Because if you could sell the land, what's called the Heter Mechira, if you could sell the land, then you don't have to, then the Shemitah doesn't apply to you. And some people said, you can't sell the land to a non-Jew. And Rav Kook says, of course you can. Have you never heard of the Rabbit and Rav Yosef Karo? You could sell land to Muslims. They're at least as much monotheists as you are. Furthermore, Rav Kook says, when you have an entire nation that follows the Noahide laws, you consider them all effectively Gerim Toshavim. Stop giving me a headache about whether Muslims are Gerim Toshavim. They're monotheists. Stop it already. One more step. Here's the problem that Rav Herzog has. And here I want you to follow me for one second here. Because, as I've said, for this generation, the fundamental problem is religious, theological, not political. Christians being allowed to live in the land is a much bigger halachic challenge than Muslims. Because in traditional Jewish law, Islam is unequivocally monotheistic. Christianity is questionable. I find it fascinating, by the way, one of the most interesting German theologians of the last, you know, generation, Jürgen Moltmann, says, I'm not a monotheist, I'm a Trinitarian, which is an outrageous comment for a Christian to be making. But, right, most Christians will say, what do you mean? I'm a Trinitarian and a monotheist. Moltmann says, I'm not a monotheist. I believe in three. Okay, they're one, but I believe in three. So that is a big problem. If you're basically saying they can live here because they're not idolaters, remember, you're not saying this is a modern democratic state, freedom of religion. We're not saying that. But if you're saying they're not idolaters about Muslims, what are you going to say about Christians? And here you end up having to rely on this very kind of confusing and, let's just say, metaphysically strange halachic position that emerges in the Middle Ages, that Gentiles are permitted to engage in what is called shituf, right? In worshiping the God of Israel and some other stuff, whereas for Jews, it is idolatry. It is a very strange argument to say this is idolatry for Jews and permitted for everybody else. But that's what Rav Herzog essentially does. In other words, what I've tried to sort of lay out here is that for Rav Herzog, there is a political dimension to his argument. We can't apply discriminatory laws even if we would want to, because we don't have the power to do that. And an internal halachic dimension, it's fine for them to live here even on halachic terms. So you might say the argument is two-pronged. Even if I have not convinced you on the halachic point, I still fall back on the political necessity of what I'm saying. You think I'm wrong? Fine, think I'm wrong. You still can't act on it. All of this, again, to belabor this point to the point of ridiculous, is treated as a religious issue, not a nationalistic one. And so, as I've said, Muslims are an easier problem than Christians. So you have this solution to the question of Muslims and Christians, non-Jews, living in the land. Now you have the second big problem. There's actually three big problems, but I'm only going to try to tackle two of them tonight. The third one that has popped up a lot in the last 25 years is actually selling property to non-Jews. The second one is, can non-Jews hold positions of authority? Says Maimonides in the Laws of Kings, Ein ma'amidim melech mikahal gerim. We don't, this is a surprising law for many people, we don't allow a convert to be king. Afilu achar kama dorot ad shitiyeh imo miYisrael. If you do not have a Jewish mother, you cannot be a king. This would be a discussion for another day, which I am not qualified at this moment to have. And then he says, "V'lo l'malchut bilvad ela l'chol srarot shebi Yisrael." The exclusion of even converts, let alone non-Jews, does not apply to monarchy alone, but to all positions of authority within Israel. That word srara is going to be extremely important. By the way, in a totally separate register, it's going to become very important in the debates about women as rabbis. But that's a whole nother discussion. Taken in a straightforward way, what Maimonides is saying here would mean that even if a non-Jew may live in the land, they will never be permitted to play any role in governance whatsoever. Now watch Herzog the Halachist do his jujitsu. This only ever applied, he says, to lifetime appointments, which are also hereditary appointments passed on to one's children. It obviously is not talking about temporary roles as you have in a democracy. This issue here was giving the status of having power. This issue is about preventing someone non-Jewish from having ongoing and even multi-generational power. So it does not talking about someone having a 3-year term or even someone having a longer term and then going off into retirement and being replaced by someone else. And furthermore, says Rav Herzog, this only applies to srara. Srara, authority, refers to that which is forced upon the people. This doesn't apply to leaders whom the people themselves choose to rule over them. The point is, you don't take a Gentile and make him ruler of the Jews in the land of Israel. But if the Jews want to vote for him, so vote for him. Gesundheit, that's not what this halacha is about. In other words, there's a kind of argument that says the kind of political arrangement that Maimonides is imagining are not the kind of political arrangements in a modern state. Now, again, as I mentioned before, scholars tend to read Herzog in different ways. Some seem to take him at face value. It's only b'diavad. It's because we have no choice that we let them be here and hold positions of authority. And other scholars interpret him differently, right? That is to say, really, he knows he has to have a democracy. He wants to have a democracy. At the end of the day, this is going to be a judgment call because he's not going to sit. You don't have his diary that says, here's what I was up to as I was doing this. Now, it's worth noting before we move on that the other great posek of this period, a man named Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, who was the Rosh Yeshiva at Merkaz HaRav, Rav Kook's yeshiva, he says, discrimination of this sort will have a massively negative impact on the minority's relationship to this country. Do you really want to have a situation in which you are actively eliciting resentment on the part of the minority Muslim population living under your rule? And second of all, he says, in other countries all over the world, we as Jews struggle for equal rights. And in fact, most countries have by now granted them to us. The moral basis of our claims will fall apart if we discriminate in this way in Israel. Everything we've always advocated for will be shown to be a sham. So a halachic solution must be found. I tell you that the answer must be, of course they can live here and have public roles. Now, this is on one level interpretable as a utilitarian argument. If you don't accept them in these kinds of roles, we ourselves will lose our status in other nations. But one smells a certain kind of moral argument under the surface here too, which is, what are we, a bunch of ridiculous hypocrites? Right? Oh, equal rights for Jews everywhere, equal rights for Palestinians except in Palestine. No, you can't do that. But I now want to introduce you to what I will call the wild card, the source that is extremely, extremely difficult to read from a modern perspective. This is the Rambam. Im hishlimu v'kiblu sheva mitzvot shenitztavu b'nei noach aleihem, ein horgin mehen neshama v'harei hen limas. If these nations whom we capture accept the seven Noahide laws, we don't kill any of them, but rather they become subjugated. This is a really difficult line. The subjugation they must accept consists of their being on a lower level, scorned and humbled. They must never raise their heads in Israel or against Israel. Ela yukvushim tachat yadam. They must remain subjugated under their rule, captured under their rule. V'lo yitmanu al Yisrael l'shum davar shebaolam. They may never be appointed over a Jew in any matter whatsoever. This is hard stuff. And here, I don't mean this apologetically. I mean this actually at the opposite of apologetics. I'll explain if it's not clear what I mean by this. This is a fantasy in a realm of, in a period of powerlessness. The reason I don't mean it as an apologetic is, my whole point is, it is extraordinarily irresponsible to imagine that you can simply decide contemporary Jewish law in a sovereign Jewish state based on a statement like this. It's a very problematic assumption. Now, here's a really interesting thing about how halacha works. How does Rav Herzog deal with this source in his long discussion of the status of Gentiles in the land of Israel? He never mentions it. He just ignores it. Acts as if it isn't there. Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his students will very much not ignore it and will make it central to their halachic and political worldview. Are there questions that I should be stopping to take before we go on to the 1967 generation?
For sure. So first, there are a few comments calling out a parallel to the Rambam's concept of Dimi. And I'm wondering if you want to comment on that.
Here's what's been going on in the back of my mind as I'm talking about this. When the Rambam talks about the Messianic period, he goes out of his way to say, the point of the Messianic period is not for us to subjugate others the way they've subjugated us. And yet in the Laws of Kings, it a little bit sounds like that's exactly what he's fantasizing about. And what you might be seeing here is simply a reversal of a Dimi fantasy. I don't know. I never know. Am I pronouncing that word right? I'm not quite sure how it's pronounced in Arabic. But, right, it's a reversal of that fantasy. I think that that's a fair point. I'm not an expert in that, but that has always seemed to me part of what's going on here, right? That we will reverse subjugation. And in light of that, it's very striking that he seems to repudiate that in his own messianic vision. So I don't have a huge amount to add. Yeah, Shira, go ahead.
I'd also like to raise a question from Jennifer, who asks, what is the significance of the land in these commentaries versus a general question of non-Jews living among us? Is there any sense in which these sources are commenting on a theoretical Jewish-ruled society that is not specific to the land of Israel?
Yeah, there are halachic discussions of this, which I don't know that I would be able to pull out of my memory without going back and looking at them. There are some debates about whether some of these principles would apply, for example, in like, you know, non-Jews coming to live in a medieval Jewish kehillah or something like that. I think that the complicating issue is those kehillot did not have the kind of sovereignty that Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his students will fantasize that Israelis have. Meaning, the question is, would it ever actually come to fruition in such a situation? Right? Because the kehillot always had someone they had to look up to for permission to function as kehillot. I have that vague sense in the back of my mind that there is a debate that took place, if I'm not mistaken, in one of the issues of Truman, which is kind of one of the halachic, you know, halachic journals where a lot of these questions get played out. And that you have a bunch of religious Zionist rabbis arguing about precisely this point. But I'm sorry that I am not Ethan Tucker. I can't pull that right out of my, I can't pull the source out right off the top of my head. I can look it up.
The last question I'd highlight, and it's sort of a few questions that have come together, is one about context. When you were describing Rev Herzog's position, you spoke about the jujitsu that he's doing, and you had a comment about what makes this jujitsu as opposed to, you know, reading the Rambam into a modern context. And like, when do we get to do that? And when are we stuck with the literal text of what's written?
Yeah, I mean, okay. So that is an extraordinarily difficult question and will depend a tremendous amount on the eye of the beholder. I mean, one of the things that, as all of you know, goes on in Jewish culture all the time is debates and discreditings based on who is the person doing the interpreting. Who has the right to interpret what is a really important question. One thing I might say somewhat playfully is Rav Herzog, because he's Rav Herzog, can ignore this Rambam. You know, a posek from Hadar ignoring this Rambam would get called out for ignoring it. Right? I mean, in other words, the question is in some ways really political. I don't know if that's what the questioner meant, But I mean, I think that that's almost unavoidably the case. I remember, I will not name names, but I'll not name names of the rabbi who said this. I remember as a kid in the yeshiva in Israel saying to a prominent Rosh Yeshiva, if you published Rabbi Joel Roth's tshuva on egalitarianism and signed your name to it, would it be valid halacha? And he said, of course. But I didn't write it. The conservative rabbi wrote it. It's puzzle. And also, he has no community that's observant in the first place, so halachic discourse is a joke. But if I wrote that tshuva, of course it would be valid halacha. Why not? Now, you can regard that as, oh yeah, well, that makes sense. You can regard that as outrageous. You can regard that as makes sense and it's outrageous, or somewhere in between. But there's a lot of weight that goes on here. I mean, one of the things you often see in halachic debates is, I mean, think about what I mentioned before. How many people will say Rabbi Yosef Karo's reading of the Rambam is wrong and I know it, but it's Rabbi Yosef Karo, so it's fine. I'm going to go with it anyway. That's an interesting kind of argument to make. I think I've now not answered any of the three questions with any usefulness, but, you know, I'm doing my best. Okay. So after 1967, the question shifts from whether non-Jews can live in the land to a more nationalistic political question, the status of Palestinian Arabs in a Jewish state. And among Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his circle, it becomes a question not only of Jew and non-Jew, but explicitly of conqueror and conquered. Accordingly, the shift from whether or not potential Gerim Toshavim are loyal to the Torah's norms shifts a little bit to the question of whether or not they are loyal to the Jewish state. What is the most dramatic expression of this shift? Rav Eliezer Melamed, author of Pnine Halacha, a book that has become sort of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch in the modern Orthodox set these days, right, argues, just think about somebody saying this in 1500, that the Christian population of Israel is much closer to having the status of Ger Toshav than the Muslim one, because Christians are not a coalesced ethnic group in the land that is actively, in addition to being a coalesced ethnic group, hostile to the government. They're just Christians living there. Just to be clear, and to say this in a very scholarly way, in traditional theological terms, that argument is simply nuts, right? The argument that a Christian would be closer to a Ger Toshav than a Muslim is just, I mean, I'm not evaluating whether it's a good argument for 1980. I'm actually not interested in evaluating it right now. I just want to understand that it represents a radical innovation that reflects how the question shifts from a theological question to a political national one. Now, interestingly, in Tzvi Yehuda Cook's circle, there is not a lot of halachic writing on this question. There are simply a couple of pieces that seemingly, because they are not widely criticized, are accepted. What I just said is quite a controversial claim, and I am not convinced that it's right, although it is a claim shared by most historians of halakha from the 20th century. There are a couple of classic essays here. They are the ones who are most outspoken, and they are pretty out there, okay? The position that these two prominent papers take, these prominent tshuvot, is to place lands captured in 1967 under Israeli sovereignty, but to find a halachic rationale for not granting full civil rights to the Palestinian residents of those territories. And please also keep in mind what I said earlier, not all religious Zionists are represented by this faction, although this faction has grown over time. I should note, although I don't really understand this argument, I have to say, that some historians think that the real turning point in halachic treatment of Palestinians was actually not the triumph of in 1967, but the rise in terrorist attacks against settlers in the early 1980s. These tshuvot emerge in the 1980s. The first one I want to talk about, the main one I want to talk about, is Rav Elisha Aviner. Elisha Aviner is the brother of the much more famous Shlomo Aviner. Elisha Aviner is a teacher at the Hesder Yeshiva in Maale Adumim. And he writes a paper called Ma'amad HaYishmaelim Bimdinat Yisrael Lefi HaHalacha, the status of Ishmaelites in the land of Israel, in the state of Israel, according to Halacha. The historian of Halacha, Chaim Burgansky, points out, he can't prove this, that the very use of the term Yishmaelim is actually a kind of ethnic slur. You're referring to them as Yishmaelim rather than Muslimim is a way of referring to them as he puts it, B'nei Ha'ama, children of the maidservant. Note from the title, the issue is not non-Jews, but specifically Arabs. The key question is not religious, but political. The issue is not just, or even primarily, non-Jewish individuals living in the land, but rather the status of an ethnic minority that sees itself as a collective, and that is, crucially, hostile towards the very existence of the state. In other words, by the way, for whatever this is worth, much of what Elisha Aviner says about Palestinians, he would not say about foreign workers or non-Jewish Olim. He's talking about what he sees as a kind of coalesced political, I don't know how even how to say this, ethnic group in the state. Please understand here, to belabor the word, I'm not advocating this position, believe me. Because of the Rambam, he says, they're not Gerim Toshavim. We know they can't be a Ger Toshav, right? I'm not doing this jujitsu a la Rav Herzog and my teacher, Rav Shaul Yisraeli. I reject that. And by the way, he says, when Rav Kook permitted non-idolaters to own the land, he permitted that for the purpose of Shemitah. He wasn't establishing some big legal principle. You can't just take a technical argument that someone makes in one local place and make it a general principle, to which other halachic thinkers will say, really? Who says? We do that all the time. But he says, no, Rav Kook didn't mean to say non-Jews can now own as much land. And no, he didn't mean that at all. He meant, I can find a way to say that the Heter Mechira, the Shemitah bypass, is possible. And then he says, because they are not Gerim Toshavim, there is no actual mitzvah to look after them or take care of their needs. Letting them live in the land is only permitted in extenuating circumstances, Sha'at Hadchak. Turning to the wild card text, as I called it, the subjugation text, Aviner concludes, they need to be Nivzim, that is, they require national subjugation, Kni'ah Le'umit, not just regular servitude. Velo yitmanu, they may not be appointed. They cannot hold any government positions. And they must be lemas. They must pay taxes and do national service at the will of the government. Aviner goes so far as to emphasize not just conformity with these rules, but willing acceptance of them. He wants to make rules about the consciousness that Palestinians should have while living in the land. And really strikingly, on this point, he is so extreme that even other people in Tzvi Yehuda Cook circle come out and say, where are you making this stuff up, right? There's nothing in Jewish law that says anything like that, right? As one person, Amnon Sugarman, Rosh Yeshivat HaGolan, whose name I also put in the sheet, but I don't have his dates. I mean, he's still alive. Still the Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshivat HaGolan. He says, I see no mitzvah for Palestinians to love us, right? Or even to celebrate that we are sovereign. They just have to accept that they live in a Jewish state. In contrast to Rav Herzog, Aviner goes on to argue, they can't hold public roles because they are an ethnic minority. Allowing them to have such roles would endanger Jewish sovereignty in the land. In other words, seemingly devoid of any sense of irony whatsoever, Aviner points out that as individuals, they have every right, but as a nationality, they have no rights at all. They are not, he says, partners in the state. By the way, Chaim Burgansky, the historian of Halakha, points out, if you were really playing out the logic of your position, Rav Aviner, they shouldn't be allowed to vote either. Aviner concludes by insisting that since he insists on Arabs as individuals being treated well, his is a moral position, emda musarit mutzaka. Awareness of the moral problems responded to here, I should say, in a kind of fiat. This is moral because I've decided that they have individual rights and therefore they're being treated well. There's no consideration at all that I can find in his essay of the issue that preventing national rights might be a moral issue in itself. By the way, not everyone agrees with that. Some people would say, I am opposed to nationalism of all forms, and I don't find it compelling. I mean, right, one of the arguments that people make about the left all the time is, right, we're not in favor of Jewish nationalism, but Palestinian nationalism is great. The argument he does not make, so I want to make it clear, meaning the argument from silence is that the urge for national self-determination is somehow not a moral issue. And what I'm suggesting is that in a funny way, this extreme right-wing position would have certain extreme left-wing allies, right? But it is, in his case, an extreme right-wing position. Now, there is an irony, as Chaim Bourgansky points out. Aviner thinks, he says, we have to protect our unique role in the world, which is in part to exemplify yashrut musarit, moral integrity. And here, that seems to mean denying rights to those who live under our power. This is Bourgansky, who is a very kind of like straight up historian of halacha, calls this in good modern Hebrew, absurd, right? This is, he says, simply an absurd claim. Now, some of Aviner's positions are so extreme that it is really striking that in Tchumin, this journal that he publishes in, the editor basically says, wait, slow down a minute. I'm going to publish your paper, but I'm going to publish a rejoinder in which I point out, first of all, the idea that Maimonides articulates that Gentiles have the status of mas and avdut, right, of servitude, right, that does not apply when we're not at war, right? It's not a general thing, non-Jews living under our power must be humiliated. It's about what happens in war when you're trying to win a battle. And then he says, given the international scene and the status of the state, you would have to be nuts to do this kind of thing. To which Aviner says, maybe, but that's only b'diavad. L'chadchila, ideally we would do exactly what I said. I think one of the things that is worth noticing here is that Herzog and Yisraeli were very focused on how Israel would be viewed on the international scene. They had a sense of Israel's precarity as a nation. Aviner, in contrast, is self-confident and even brazen in the way that the 1967 war arguably enabled. There is no consideration at all in his essay of categories like Darkei Shalom, the ways of peace, or Ein Yadenut Keifa, we do not have the real power here. That is in some ways, that is the most dramatic shift, is the sort of like swagger that you find in Tshuvot from Tzvi Yehuda Circle after 1967. The kind of swagger that is precisely what Herzog is warning against. And as for Rav Yisraeli's argument that Jews would lose the moral claim to be treated well in other countries, Rav Yaakov Ariel, Rosh Yeshiva in Yamit, longtime chief rabbi of Ramat Gan, responding to this, but not by name, says, real Judaism never wanted Jews to be accepted as full and equal citizens in other lands. What we are offering Arabs is precisely what we always ask for ourselves, to be respected citizens who respect the owners of the place, Baalei HaBayit, maybe even as Gerim Toshavim. We never wanted, it's only assimilationist Jews who wanted to be full citizens in Germany. By the way, he's not even the most extreme. Rabbi Yisrael Rosen, founder of Tzomet, usually known among American modern Orthodox Jews for creative halachic solutions to problems of technology, was also a kind of political extremist. Rosen says, if you look at the Rambam, Rambam says, you can't have neighborhoods of non-Jews or idolaters in the land. I'm going to talk about that non-Jews or idolaters thing in a minute. So Rosen, based on this passage in Maimonides, Paskins, decides for law that Palestinians need to be spread out and live in Jewish towns and neighborhoods. He argues from a nationalistic position for the integration of Palestinians into Jewish towns and cities because it is halachically forbidden for there to be Palestinian communities, because after all, that will threaten Jewish sovereignty and create the possibility of autonomy, etc. He then acknowledges that the sources can be read differently, but thinks their thrust is to prevent, even at heavy social and spiritual cost, any hint of autonomy or independent self-rule of non-Jews in the land of Israel. Now, the generation of the founders sees Israeli democracy in a positive light and wants to synthesize, or to use the language I used earlier, hold together democracy and received halakha. The post-67 generation takes a critical stance towards the state, focusing on its democratic treatment of all its non-Jewish citizens, and especially Palestinian ones. And one of the things that has happened is that since 1967, in a series of steps, much of the more radical rabbinate in the religious Zionist world has grown more and more complexly hostile to governments. I'm saying this in a convoluted way because there is a kind of really interesting, I mean, on some level even a little bizarre, but it is fascinating debate among right-wing religious Zionist rabbis about to what degree they are still mamlachti, to what degree they still fundamentally support the Israeli government no matter what it does, and to what degree they kind of reject the government because it makes decisions that are against halakha as they understand it. This comes up during Oslo, this comes up during the Hitnatkut, the disengagement, comes up over and over again. It's also just worth underlining something before we go on, that the generation of the founders were dealing with Arabs who were citizens. When Rav Herzog is writing, certainly when he's writing post-1948, all the Arabs he's talking about have equal rights already. When it comes to people like Elisha Aviner, when he's writing about Arabs, what he often has in mind is people who don't have equal rights. He knows that that is a moral and political problem, right? He doesn't deny that it's a moral problem. He just decides by fiat that he solved it. He wants to argue that not granting rights is somehow also okay. But the fundamental political situation is totally different. It's almost like the halachic problem, if you will, in 1948 is to validate some form of equal rights. I understand that there are arguments about whether those rights were really equal. All that is fine. But like the assumption of a halachic posek in 1952 is that they're equal. And so I'm going to find a way halachically to say that. The argument that someone like Elisha Aviner sets for himself is quite the opposite. I'm going to find a way to validate the non-voting rights, etc., of Palestinians living in the West Bank. Okay, now, I want to do something way too quickly. I want to talk very briefly about some more modernizing non-Tzvi Yehuda Cook voices who see the fundamental issue of Arabs in Israel as about ethics and theology. First of all, Rabbi Yehuda Amital, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, part of Tzvi Yehuda's circle, but a massively dissenting voice from his peers. Rav Amital does something sort of amazing, and I may be overreading him, but this is what I take him to be saying. You want to start quoting passages in Rambam to me to validate mistreating people? Okay, fine. I know the Mishnah Torah also. Watch this. Asur l'shaker b'vritam u'l'chazev lahem achar shehishlimu v'kiblu sheva mitzvot. When you make a covenant with non-Jews, it is forbidden to be untruthful to them or unfaithful to the covenant one has signed after they have shown that they follow the Noahide laws. He says, the rights enumerated in Israel's Declaration of Independence represent a commitment that we have made and are therefore religiously binding upon us. Also, he says, the obligation of sanctifying God's name and the prohibition on desecrating it require us to fulfill every promise made by the leaders of our people. And the biggest promises we've made in 2,000 years as a people are made in the Declaration of Independence. So we don't even have to look at all these other sources in Maimonides that you're quoting because they don't apply. We made a covenant with people who accept the Noahide laws. We made a commitment. This has the status of halakha. Breaking the promises that we made in the Declaration of Independence would be a very grave sin. Avon chamur me'od. And he goes on to emphasize obligations that stem from Chilul Hashem and Kiddush Hashem, from desecrating or sanctifying God's name, carry even greater halachic weight than many other mitzvot. Other mitzvot are simply deferred. You can quote every Rambam you want, and it is deferred by the prohibition of desecrating God's name. And by the way, desecrating God's name, I think, importantly, does not mean it's going to make us look bad in the eyes of the Gentiles. It means it will reflect poorly on God the way we conduct ourselves. Now, what's the biblical proof text of this? Rav Amital beautifully notes, this is quite a skillful argument. He says, remember the Gibeonites? The Israelites were actively tricked into making a covenant with them, which meant that the covenant was not binding. Everybody knew that. The Gibeonites knew that, and the Israelites knew that. But nevertheless, the Israelites kept their word because that's what a covenant means. All the more so when you willingly make a covenant. That's modernist position number one, the rebel in the Tzvi Yehuda camp. Second position, Rabbi Ben Zion Meir Chai Uziel, 1880 to 1953, first Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel from 1938 to 1953. He starts out by agreeing with Rav Herzog about the fact that we only have a country, he says, because of the United Nations. So we have to follow United Nations principles. But then he adds, in a way that, again, this goes to something Shira mentioned. I don't know if this was Shira's question or quoting from someone in the chat. But he, because he's Rav Uziel, he can say this. He says, it's only fair. You can't expect people to pay taxes and help defend the country and then not allow them to elect or be elected. This is simply, he says, shurat adin. This is the basic requirement of law. By the way, this argument is exactly parallel to what he's going to say about women's suffrage. When Rav Kook is opposed to women's suffrage, a topic for another lecture in another year, Rav Uziel, although he does not, he shies away from fighting with Rav Kook in public, says, the reason women can vote is because they're expected to obey the political authorities. You can't make someone obey someone and not give them any say in who that someone is. That's immoral. This is Rav Uziel as a kind of proto-feminist. Now, Eliezer Haddad, an historian of halakha, makes the following interesting two-step argument. He says, you know, when Rav Uziel says that they're helping defend the country, this would not help an argument for Arab rights today, as long as Arabs don't serve in the army. And then he adds in prong two, but it also raises massive questions about the rights of Haredim in the country if you're going to take them away from Arabs. Elsewhere, Rav Uziel writes, I love the fact that he can just say this. One equal civil law for all who dwell in the land is a Jewish value. Quote, the mitzvot of the Torah obligate us. Love and respect and equal rights and freedom of religion and freedom of national affiliation for every people and every person who dwells in our land in peace and faithfulness. This is, he says, the values of the Torah. This is, for those of you who like this kind of discussion, not legal formalism, right? This is basically just saying, look, I can discern certain values that underline the whole discussion of Torah, even if there are certain laws that Elisha Aviner is going to quote one day that seem to stand in the face of this, no. The values of Torah are equality, decency, etc. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who we spoke about last time and who I mentioned briefly before, who was Rav Uziel's greatest student and continuator, says, so much of halachic discourse deals not with non-Jews per se, but with idolaters. This is, for those familiar with the history of halakha, a move that is similar to and dependent on Menachem HaMeiri's argument in the Middle Ages, that rabbinic sources about discriminating against non-Jews were never talking about non-Jews. They were talking about idolaters. And then he says, our obligations to non-Jews are based in Musar TV Enoshi, basic human morality, as it is expressed concretely in Israel's Declaration of Independence. So when I was personally in this phase of studying the history of religious Zionism, my idea for a dissertation was basically to write about sort of all of the religious Zionisms that lost and got overshadowed by what happened in the wake of 1967 and the rise of Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Anyone who's interested in that, I'm happy to spend hours talking about this. I'm like kind of fascinated by this and distressed by it, but also fascinated in the intellectual history side of it. I wanted to sort of just point out that there were voices who actively resisted the direction that a lot of the discourse took. And this, I'm really talking here about halachic discourse around democracy. There's also lots of resistance to the messianic talk. There's lots of resistance to some of the more metaphysically racist talk. I mean, one of the things I think that I did not talk about tonight, simply because I couldn't figure out how to integrate it and not keep you here till 11 o'clock, is that part of what animates Tzvi Yehuda Cook's circle that is so kind of problematic from a modern perspective is this tradition inherited from Kabbalah that there is somehow a distinction between Jews and non-Jews that is essentialist, which some of you have heard me talk about over the years is what Maimonides basically declared war on, the notion that what distinguished Jews and non-Jews is not hardware but software, right? There's nothing that differentiates a Jew from a non-Jew other than culture, right? I have the Torah, you have something else, but okay. Traditions, cultural traditions, religious traditions do not interpret themselves. You can take Judaism and create a Taliban out of it. And you can take it into a theologically grounded project of affirming the dignity and worth of all humanity and lots in between. One of the things I talk about in the introduction to my forthcoming book, which is called Judaism is About Love, is that someone could write a book called Judaism is About Hate and muster lots and lots of sources. By the way, I had this experience. I was a scholar in residence in a synagogue last Shavuot, and I kid you not, a man came up to me and said, "I disagree with you. I think Judaism is about hate." And I said, "I wrote about you. I literally wrote about you in the introduction to my book. You're the guy I'm talking about," right? On some level, to interpret a tradition is to make choices. And the question, of course, is choices guided by what? Just as who one asks halachic questions to is a choice one makes. I could go on about this for hours and hours and hours. One of the most fascinating cultural phenomena of American Jewish history is the extent to which, for generations, modern Orthodox Jews in America ask their halachic questions to halachic decision makers who fundamentally disdain the project of modern Orthodoxy. The construction of Rav Moshe Feinstein as a modern Orthodox posek is a fascinating cultural phenomenon. He had no respect for modern Orthodoxy. So what you need, ultimately, are interpreters who know a lot, and who are thoughtful, humane, compassionate, and insistent on affirming the dignity of all people. And I want to emphasize both knowing a lot and this kind of compassion. Without knowing a lot, you end up with a culture that is tepid and watered down. One of the dilemmas I've been reading, I won't mention names here, I've been reading a manuscript by a prominent Israeli Reform rabbi who really movingly talks about, I believe that what we talk about in the Reform movement is true, but I have no idea whether it's plausible or viable in the real world. Fascinating, kind of almost like a creed de coeur about the struggle of how, he talks about how do you not have commitment that's tepid. Am I pronouncing that word correctly? It is pronounced tepid, right? And compassionate, because otherwise you end up with Itamar Ben-Gvir as the leader of a religious Zionist community. You know, ultimately, if you want to move a culture, you have to be an expert in its language. It's not negotiable. You really have to learn how to speak its language. But who you entrust to speak in its language is a decision we all make. It's not just a question about leaders. It's also a question about all of us, about who you take seriously as an authority and why. and under what circumstances?
There were a handful of questions about how this conversation plays into ratio demographics, and a question around is
ratio demographics.
So the question being, are these sources imagining the possibility of a minority of Jews ruling over or subjugating a majority of non-Jews, or in what way is the ratio relevant?
I think that they are probably not imagining such a scenario. Why they are not imagining such a scenario is a combination of faith and when they're writing. Meaning it's striking. Both Rosen and Aviner write their Tshuvot in the 80s. I sort of wonder if they had written them in 2010, whether they might talk differently. I suspect that Aviner and Rosen and that circle would say, look, if it's a minority ruling a majority, we're still the sovereigns here. Nachnu balei habayit. I mean, that's horrifying to me, but it is what it is. I suspect that it's not a live question for them. Yeah, I'm sorry I can't do better than that. But since the question was asked as a factual question, I feel like I can just give a factual reply and leave the bigger moral questions for another day.
I'd also like to raise up a question that came in towards the beginning of the session that was looking at the language of the Rambam in the first source and asking, what is the connection between the Jubilee and the status of the Ger Toshav?
Yeah, really good question. Debates about that exist in the interpretation of the Rambam. The most recent thing I was able to find about that by a scholar, a historian of Halakha, was that it's an indirect way of saying this only applies when a majority of the Jewish people or an overwhelming majority of the Jewish people are living in the land, because that's when the Jubilee will apply again. And that may tie this back to the previous question, meaning you only accept Gerim Toshavim when they don't threaten to dilute the Jewish majority in the land. In other words, the argument there is that the Jubilee is not the Jubilee. The Jubilee is almost a symbolic way of talking about when an enormous majority of the Jewish people are living in the land again. Whether that's right again, I don't know. I was not able to get my hands upon this, to get my hands this week on, Gerald Blitzstein has a book called Ekronot Midiniyot B'Mishnat HaRambam, Political Principles in the Rambam's Teaching. I suspect he has a long discussion there, but I, for technical reasons, just couldn't get my hands on that book. I was reading something else this week about what the Rambam has in mind there. I don't know whether it's right, but it is the most recent argument I've seen.